Central Time. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, folk schools teach traditional arts and crafts, and they're more popular than ever here in Wisconsin. We'll visit two of those schools where you can learn everything from cheese making to blacksmithing.
First, it's time for our weekly look at national politics. In the last 2 weeks, Washington has had to address major sexual assault and harassment allegations, just like Hollywood has.
Roy Moore is an Alabama Republican running for a Senate seat that was once held by Jeff Sessions. Moore has been accused of seeking sexual or romantic relations with teenagers when he was in his 30s, as reported last week by the Washington Post. Since then, at least one more woman has come forward with her story, and key Republicans have discouraged Moore's bid for that Senate seat. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Roy Moore should step aside. The women who've come forward are entirely credible. He's obviously not fit to be in the United States Senate. And we've looked at all the options to try to prevent that from happening.
And you can share your thoughts. Should Roy Moore drop his bid for Senate, you can call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can tell us how you think Republican lawmakers should react to the allegations against Moore. Again, call 800-642-1234.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on Paul Ryan and House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, we heard the Senate Majority Leader there. What other reactions are you hearing from Republicans with the allegations here against Roy Moore?
Well, Speaker Ryan weighed in yesterday on the situation, even though he's a member of the House on the other side of the Capitol. But he also said that Roy Moore is unfit to serve in the Congress and should quit the race. Probably the loudest call for on Roy Moore was from Cory Gardner. He runs the campaign committee for Senate Republicans. And he said that if Roy Moore is elected to the United States Senate, fellow senators will vote to expel him from the body. And that really raised some eyebrows and is one of the options, I think, that Mitch McConnell even alluded to. Certainly a very untenable situation for Republicans right now.
So how are Republicans scrambling to try to manage this? Moore doesn't appear to be ready to step down. We'll get more into that in just a bit. But there's been talk of write-in campaigns for a few different names at this point. What are we hearing?
Well, that's right. I mean, there is sort of a behind-the-scenes effort to draft Jeff Sessions, the now Attorney General who formerly held that seat. That's why we're in this situation with the special election to begin with, because Jeff Sessions resigned to serve as Attorney General. A lot of people want him to mount a write-in campaign and reclaim his Senate seat that he once held. The only problem is Jeff Sessions has indicated or signaled that he is not very interested in going back to the United States Senate. So that sort of puts them back at square one. They don't have a lot of good options, and as you noted, Roy Moore has refused to drop out of the race, and he's denied the allegations. And, you know, it's very unclear where Republicans go from here.
I want to give a listen to Roy Moore, Senate candidate in Alabama.
After 40-something years of fighting this battle, I'm now facing allegations. And that's all the press want to talk about. But I want to talk about the issues. I want to talk about where this country's going. And if we don't come back to God, we're not going anywhere.
We've seen some polling out in Alabama showing various things. I mean, this hasn't helped Roy Moore, clearly, but it's not a sure thing that he would lose this at this point, is it?
Well, we actually saw a new poll that was leaked to the press today, I believe a Republican poll that showed him down significantly in the race. I think this was an attempt, at least people are reading this as an attempt to try to force him to drop out, showing him that there's really no path to you know, being able to keep this seat. And, you know, Republicans don't want to lose the seat. This is a Senate seat in a deep red state, Alabama. It's been red for a long time, and it's critically important for Republicans right now that they be able to hold this seat. given that they are dealing with some big issues such as tax reform right now, we could see a vote in a matter of weeks in the Senate on tax reform. So, you know, they don't want to lose this seat. It's just right now they realize they're making a calculation that if Roy Moore wins election, it could do damage for the party up and down the ballot for 2018.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about the latest news out of the nation's capital, including Republican reactions to allegations against their Senate candidate in Alabama, Roy Moore. Let's go to our callers. Andy is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Andy, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I just want to make a statement. All men are deemed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. That is fair. Also, if he was actually guilty, there would be lawsuits filed against him.
Andy, thanks for the call. Now, as far as prosecution here, there's been talk about whether statute of limitations would apply if laws were broken. But at least some of the things here, Scott, aren't necessarily criminal activities. Some of them would be, as alleged, some of them wouldn't be. What are we hearing people in Washington talk about when it comes to what Andy said?
Well, I think the statute of limitations has run out on a lot of these allegations because we're talking about 35 to 40 years ago. This was when Moore was in his 30s. The women alleging sexual assault or harassment would have been in their teens, between the ages of about 14 to 16 at the time. So I think statute of limitations has run out, and in certain cases, I think the legal age in Alabama would have been 16. You know, like I mentioned before, senators are talking about expulsion if Moore is elected to the Senate. That would require a senator to file an ethics complaint, which would trigger a very formal process in which people would be called before the Ethics Committee to testify under oath, presumably including Roy Moore. And so that gets Moore into all sorts of legal predicaments in terms of testifying before Congress and telling the truth before Congress. That's where he could get into some real trouble. So senators have laid all of this out and made it very clear to Moore and his campaign, and that's what he's facing right now.
Want to get into sexual harassment in Congress. We've had a lot of attention, of course, to sexual harassment and sexual assault in every sector of the United States, basically, and Congress no exception. We've had some women in Congress lately coming forward to talk about their experiences. Here's something from a video released last month by Democrat Jackie Speier of California.
I was working as a congressional staffer. The chief of staff held my face, kissed me, and stuck his tongue in my mouth. So I know what it's like to keep these things hidden deep down inside. I know what it's like to lie awake in bed at night wondering if I was the one who had done something wrong. I know what it's like years later to remember that rush of humiliation and anger. You know what? Many of us in Congress know what it's like because Congress has been a breeding ground for a hostile work environment for far too long.
And Scott, this is bipartisan. We've heard Democrats and Republicans. We've heard sitting U.S. senators talking about their experiences as volunteers or interns or staffers as far back as the 70s. What is leadership in Congress talking about doing now?
Leadership in Congress, namely Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have decided that mandatory training is required, you know, to make sure that lawmakers, as well as their staff members and aides, are going through the correct training needed to prevent or at least curb sexual harassment and other types of you know, misdeeds from happening in the United States Capitol. You know, as you mentioned, this is an issue that is impacting, you know, every sector where there is a power dynamic. And certainly that power dynamic where you have lawmakers that are sort of running their own little fiefdoms in the Capitol is no exception. And we're hearing very personal graphic stories from lawmakers. It started with Jackie Speier, but a number of others, including Barbara Comstock of Virginia, have talked about either personal stories or stories that have been relayed to them by staff members. Senator Claire McCaskill has talked about when she worked as a staffer in the Capitol House, she would avoid the elevators in the Capitol because it put her in very close proximity with male members of Congress, and all sorts of things might have happened. So it's a big awakening on Capitol Hill, just like it is across the entire country, and leaders Ryan and McConnell are trying to get out in front of this and ensure more instances of this don't happen in the future.
Scott Wong is with us for a weekly look at national politics. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the effort to mandate anti-sexual harassment training in Congress? Is it long overdue, or do you think it does enough? And what do you think the effort to roll back the Affordable Care Act through the revised Republican tax plan? We're actually going to get to that in a little bit, just putting that on your radar. And do you think that that's a good way to offset the costs? You can call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're picking up our weekly look at national politics with Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what you think the Republican effort to tie the Affordable Care Act and a rollback of the health care mandate to the tax plan. Do you think it'll help Americans in the long run? What are your thoughts on the 2018 midterm elections? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott, let's get into that tax plan. Both chambers of Congress pursuing somewhat different plans. We're finding out in the Senate plan now they want to end the health care mandate in their tax overhaul bill. What do we know about that?
Well, that's right. We know that Republicans failed in their quest earlier this year to repeal and replace Obamacare. The Senate couldn't muster the vote. So the Senate Republicans are hoping to repeal the a provision of Obamacare, the individual mandate, or that mandate that requires people to have health insurance. They're trying to include that in the tax reform plan, hoping it can hitch a ride on tax reform that is now moving through the Congress. That provision or that individual mandate repeal is not included in the House version. The House is prepared to vote on their tax plan tomorrow, and leaders, Speaker Ryan and other leaders, believe that by including that health mandate in their tax bill would complicate the issue and perhaps tank the entire tax bill. So they are focused on the prize, which is tax reform. They don't want to complicate things just yet. What this means is that if the Senate actually can pass their bill with the repeal in it, then we end up in a conference committee of House and Senate negotiators. And then they will have to iron out their difference and to decide whether in the final product the Obamacare mandate repeal is included in that. So that's sort of the state of play. President Trump will be appearing on Capitol Hill tomorrow for a sort of pep rally to rally the troops ahead of the House vote. And then we expect that to be successful, and then they'll kick it over to the Senate, and it's the Senate's turn.
And we're hearing from the Wall Street Journal that Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson said he finds the Senate tax package, quote, offensive, and that he wouldn't be voting for it because it benefits corporations over other kinds of businesses. We'll watch for more details on that, Scott. But there's not a lot of wiggle room for Republican senators, is there?
That's right. They have a 52-48 majority. Mike Pence has been called in numerous times to break the tie as his job as president of the Senate, And it's entirely possible he will be called on once again to break a tie in the case of the tax reform vote. We haven't heard when that will be scheduled. They're currently marking it up in committee this week. You know, there has been some talk that Mitch McConnell may hold senators in during the Thanksgiving recess next week and work overtime. So there is a desire, certainly a desire, especially after the failure of Obamacare repeal, to get the job done on tax reform. And Trump says he wants a bill on his desk by Christmas Day.
Another wrinkle in the Senate plan we're hearing is that the individual tax cuts for individuals and families would sunset. They would end in, I think the year was 2025. There would not be a similar sunset provision for corporate tax changes. Is that something that helps meet the numbers that they need to get this thing through?
I think it's something to watch for. Certainly, you know, certainly there are a number of groups out there that would like to see these cuts made permanent. We have dealt with temporary tax cuts in the past, the Bush tax cuts, and they did sunset, and you know, they put Congress in a difficult position. If they are unable to renew those tax cuts, then Congress essentially is charged with raising taxes on Americans. And so I think it's something to watch for. I'm not sure it's going to you know, derail the bill at this point, but it's definitely something that should be on people's radar.
We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news over the last week. A lot going on. Want to look ahead a little bit to election 2018, Scott, and you're watching a bunch of Republican retirements, especially for Republicans in the House lately. What are you seeing?
Well, we like to look at trends and to see how lawmakers are reacting to the political wins. We're about a year out from the 2018 midterm elections, and we are seeing a rapid rate of Republican retirements. There have been nearly 30 from the House so far. It's not only vulnerable lawmakers like Frank Lobiondo from New Jersey or Charlie Dent from Pennsylvania, but also many from safe seats. And I think the interpretation from some folks on Capitol Hill is that, you know, there is a real threat that Republicans could lose the majority in 2018. And so a lot of these veteran lawmakers are sort of asking themselves, do I want to be sticking around here if it means I'm going to be in the minority? And so we are seeing, especially from a number of GOP chairmen, Bob Goodlatte from Virginia, Jeb Hensarling and Lamar Smith from Texas, we're seeing a number of folks who have held power. They hold power as committee chairmen. They are deciding that they've been here long enough that perhaps the risk is too great that Democrats may take back the majority and are deciding to retire instead.
Let's bring on a caller on the tax issue. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, John?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Affordable Care Act, but I do believe that having medical or access to any kind of medical procedures is a right. It's not a, you know, and it just shows the character of our leadership and government right now when they want to, you know, actually dismantle the Affordable Care Act, is regardless of how complicated or something it is, it's a step in the right direction to have exactly that, affordable care for everybody.
And John, thanks a lot for that call. John said dismantle the Affordable Care Act. The key here is this would end the individual mandate, which a lot of observers say would in effect kill a lot of what the Affordable Care Act did. Is that right?
Right. There's a feeling, especially from Democrats, that if you repeal the individual mandate, it would basically undermine the whole Obamacare marketplace system and throw throw the health U.S. health system into disarray. But Republicans, on the other hand, say, you know, this is a perfect opportunity for us to not only repeal the mandate, but that would free up, they believe, money and savings that could be applied for tax cuts in their tax reform bill. So they see this sort of as a twofer. You know, one colleague of mine described it as sort of a legislative turducken, where you're meshing health care and tax all into one right before Thanksgiving Day. So certainly the caller's concerns is prevalent on Capitol Hill, and I also think that's why you're seeing a lot of the more moderate members, especially in the House, really feel the pressure as you know, Speaker Ryan and leadership have forced members to take these tough votes, not only on health care, but on tax reform.
John, thanks for that call. Briefly, Scott, as we wrap up, more calls for more investigations of Hillary Clinton, President Trump talking about that, some members of Congress. What are we hearing from the Department of Justice and Attorney General Jeff Sessions?
That's right. Jeff Sessions was on the Hill yesterday. He appeared before a House committee. He is under enormous pressure from senior Republicans in the House to appoint a special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton, similar to the arrangement that was made with the special counsel, the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller, investigating the Russia situation. And so Sessions was on the Hill yesterday and essentially pushed back against calls from Republicans in his own party who are demanding that he appoint a special investigator to investigate former Secretary Hillary Clinton. Sessions is saying that he, you know, there are protocols that need to be followed, that he doesn't take these things lightly, that the entire process needs to be evaluated and the facts need to be produced, and he will make a decision. But it did not sound like he was leaning in that direction to hire a special prosecutor to investigate Clinton.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on House Republicans. He joined us for our weekly look at national politics. First, immigrants who came to the United States brought many items, including clothing, tools, seeds to start their farming efforts, and musical instruments. They also brought a lot of knowledge and skills that would serve them well in their new homes. Many were skilled artisans in their home country, and they continued their crafts here, which included teaching younger generations.
And these are skills like woodworking, weaving, blacksmithing, and of course much more. And today, folk art schools are keeping those traditions alive.
We visit a couple of those schools now. Terry Van Orman is executive director for Folklore Village in Dodgeville. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
And Simon Stumpf is president of the board of the Driftless Folk School in Viroqua. He's a volunteer and a student there. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, great to be here.
And Simon, how would you define a folk school? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, so our folk school is really a community of lifelong learners that are celebrating their efforts to become more resilient, both personally and as a community, in keeping alive those skills that you mentioned in the intro here, but also adding to them the contemporary skills that we know that we need, whether it's from being less reliant on fossil fuels or more reliant on your neighbors. So building up all of those skills in community and right here in our rural area.
Can you give us a sense of the range of hands-on stuff that people can do at your school?
Yeah, so, back in April, we had a class on building a solar dehydrator. Upcoming classes are around making your own cheese or deer butchering the last weekend of deer hunting right here after Thanksgiving. So really, whether it's feeding yourselves or making baskets, forging a blade, so beefing up your blacksmithing classes. There are the hard skills that you can practice and hone, literally. But then there's also that idea of doing it together with your neighbors or with local experts, so we can keep those traditions and those crafts alive.
And Terry, you're at Folklore Village in Dodgeville. That's been around for a long time, but I understand the folk school part of the program is a little newer there. What led Folklore Village to get into this?
Well, several things. One was that our founder, Gene Farwell, visited the John C. Campbell Folk School in the late 80s And at that time, she envisioned something very similar at Folklore Village, but she became ill, and for various other reasons, this never happened. So I've been here about 3 years now, and with my own background with folk schools, so I was instrumental in the founding of the Ozark Folk School at the Ozark Folk Center, and also I directed the Arkansas Craft School for 5 years, I realized this was a way that I could use my experience to help bring to fruition one of our founders' dreams. Also, it gives us a way to further enhance and expand upon our mission statement, which is to provide opportunities for individuals and communities to honor, experience, and support ethnic and traditional folk life. So it's a way we can, we've been doing music and dance for decades, but this is something we can really expand upon.
And what kind of skills are people going to be working on with some of the first offerings?
Well, in this inaugural year, we are going to stick to classes that have a Scandinavian theme. So we're going to be offering the arts of rosemauling and Scandinavian figure carving, and then various crafts, including hardanger embroidery, blacksmithing, woven heart baskets, knoll binding, shoemaking. We're going to be building a Cantaway finished musical instrument, sewing the little exterior pockets that you see on Swedish costuming, spoon carving, and jewelry making. We're also going to have some building classes. So we have been in the process for a couple years now of rebuilding a Norwegian log cabin that was originally built by a craftsman, as you were talking about in your introduction, whose name was Aslak Lee. He was a craftsman from Norway, and he built this cabin, and we moved it to Folklore Village some time ago and have been in the process of rebuilding it. And then we'll also do some foodways classes that, again, with the Scandinavian theme, like lefse and Abel Skiver and Rummegrut and things like that.
We're keeping some traditional folk arts alive here in Wisconsin. We're talking to Terry Van Orman from Folklore Village in Dodgeville and Simon Stumpf with the Driftless Folk School in Viroqua. Simon, let's talk about who's teaching these classes. I'm guessing you've got these craftspeople. What is it like for them when they get this opportunity to hand their skills over to a new group of people, maybe a new generation of people?
Sure. I think one thing that makes the Driftless Folk School unique is that we're 11 years old. We do have a campus. We do have some of the accoutrements of what you'd expect a school might have, but a lot of our classes still take place in the homes of local people and in the farms and backyards and around the kitchen tables. Last weekend, we had a sourdough bread making class. There's the starter that we use in that class was used in our very first class offered by the folk school in 2006. And it's symbolic. I mean, the metaphor is probably not lost on your listeners. We've kept alive that starter, and also that tradition. The instructor for our upcoming home creamery courses, again, the weekend after Thanksgiving, is a local herbalist, a cheesemaker, you know, very well respected in the community, a longtime teacher. And so I think the folk school, by producing a catalog, by maintaining a Facebook presence and really connecting with thousands of people across the region, is doing us service in helping promote and lift up and showcase these individuals, but also, you know, the community and the culture that they're a part of here.
And Terry, you talked about you've done this in a couple other places in the U.S., now here in Wisconsin. How does doing these traditional folk arts and crafts, how does that connect us with our heritage, our history in the country?
Well, it connects in a very tangible way, which I think is just the best way of all. You know, when you're actually making an object or a foodstuff that you're Swedish or Norwegian grandmother might have created, when you're handling timbers that were originally hewed in 1848 by a Norwegian craftsman, you know, that's a really, you know, you can touch history by doing that. And so it's so meaningful to the students when they do something like that. And most of the students that I've either taught myself, which I have used to teach weaving, and then or managed in a folk school type of situation, you know, they come away so happy and enriched, and it's a really positive thing for me to be able to do as an administrator.
And Simon,
one thing I think that's really interesting is I'm a millennial. I'm 33 years old. And I think most people assume that with YouTube, you know, the folk schools might disappear. In fact, we've seen a huge increase in the number of folk schools popping up around the country. And I think it's because of what Terry just described. There's something really powerful about practicing these skills and sharing skills in community and in person with other people. I mean, YouTube might be like a trailer or a teaser for timber frame building or home composting or what have you, to be able to do it with other people, share those skills, and maybe post your own content to social media, I think is a really powerful, a powerful driver of the increase that we're seeing in folk schools all over the country.
That's interesting, Simon. Terry, do you see that too? People might maybe get that first taste online on YouTube or whatever, but really dive in and get that firsthand experience with a folk school?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, students of mine in the past, you know, they would say, well, I used to teach weaving, so that I wanted to learn to weave. And so I bought the book and I couldn't learn from the book. So I bought the video and I watched it on the screen, and I still couldn't figure it out. And they would come to me and 5 days later they could go home and weave. So there's something really powerful about that direct transmission between like master and student that can't happen any other way.
And Simon, the blacksmithing I've seen blacksmithing demonstrations. I mean, how quick is it from getting the first lesson to actually, you know, working with the hot stuff and hammering? I'd be a little nervous, actually.
Yeah, no, the first lesson includes working with the hot stuff. Robert Schultz, our instructor for our blacksmithing courses, was one of the founding instructors, and his home is the base for those courses. You not only learn about blacksmithing and leave with a forged blade, if that's what you signed up for, or a turned piece of metal, you experience life on his homestead with his family within his reality, which I think is also the other piece that folk schools keep alive. We need so desperately in this country to be able to connect across difference. And these folk schools, they provide these portals or these opportunities for people to connect, obviously within our community, but more than half of our students come from metropolitan areas around the Midwest. And so I think for those students and for our local community who get to meet other people and make a little money too, I think it's a really powerful service that these schools or that these organizations are providing.
And Terry, can you leave us with a pep talk to try to get us motivated if people are out there thinking, yeah, maybe I'd want to do something like that?
You won't regret it. You'll love it, and it will feed a whole lifetime of learning for yourself. Do it. Just do it, and you won't be sorry that you did.
Terry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Simon, thanks for taking the time today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We've been talking to Simon Stumpf. He's president of the board of the Driftless Folk School. That's in Viroqua. And Terry Van Orman is the executive director for Folklore Village in Dodgeville. They join us to talk about folk schools here in Wisconsin and how they continue to attract enthusiastic students to learn about everything from blacksmithing to weaving to traditional music. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're listening to the song Concertina Gallop, played by Wisconsin folk musician Bob Mathewitz in the early 1980s. The recording comes courtesy of our next guest, who's been working for years to preserve many aspects of Wisconsin's unique folk culture, including music just like this. He recently received a Lifetime Achievement Award for his work.
Jim Leary joins us now. He's Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. He's also co-director of a 3-year National Endowment for the Humanities project called Local Centers Global Sounds. That's a joint venture of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures and the Mills Music Library. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, I'm delighted to be on. Thanks.
Well, congratulations on this award. We mentioned the Kenneth Goldstein Award for Lifetime Academic Leadership. That's from the American Folklore Society at its 2017 convention. Can you talk about what it meant to you to get that honor?
Well, it was pretty thrilling, I think mostly because I didn't know anything about it. It was, you know, friends and colleagues, former students and people I'm working with now who put me up for it, and I got to see the letters that they wrote, which were really nice. But I think it also speaks to the fact that any award like this for leadership, you know, has to involve working with a lot of other people, and it has to also have a purpose, and part of that purpose is, of course, to educate great students that we've had at the University of Wisconsin over the years, but also to work in partnerships with community organizations around the state and the region, as well as with different partners on campus. And I think when you do that, a whole bunch of you are working together, and you can actually make some things happen that are worthwhile.
You've done a lot of work preserving folk culture, obviously, in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. What do we mean by a phrase like folk culture?
Well, it's a little bit murky, but fundamentally we're looking at kind of the grassroots or vernacular kind of everyday culture that are practiced by people as parts of rural or working class communities or family groups or sometimes ethnic groups, indigenous people, new immigrants. All of them have special foods, they have seasonal and life cycle kind of ceremonial sorts of or celebratory things that they engage in. They have stories that are meaningful. They have little phrases or esoteric jargon or expressions. They have songs and tunes. And, of course, all those things change over time, but they're also rooted in, a longer heritage, and people adapt them continuously to kind of deal with everyday situations. So it's kind of the job of folklorists to not only document those traditions, but to also try to share them with a broader public through different kinds of public programs and developing documentary archival collections and that sort of thing.
I want to get into that music we played a few moments ago, Concertina Gallop. Tell us a little bit about that song and the musician who played it.
Well, a gallop is an old-time couple dance. It's one that isn't heard too much anymore. And this was played by a guy named Bob Mathewitz, who started playing in a family band in the 1920s. And I met him up in Ashland, Wisconsin in the late 70s and early 1980s. And I made this recording at his house in 1981. But it's played on the concertina, which originated in Saxony and in Germany, but was brought to this region in the late 19th century and really kind of took off here while it was dying out over there. And it's an example of one of these sort of long-standing regional musical forms with exponents like Bob Mathewitz that that took hold here and kind of make the Upper Midwest uniquely what it is.
We're talking to Wisconsin folklorist Jim Leary, nationally recognized folklorist, about the importance of preserving music and other pieces of folk culture. And Jim, in just a moment, I want to play another recording you shared with us from Sarah Wapoos of the Menominee Nation, talking about Indian fiddling and music from the trees. Before we listen to that, though, can you give us some background on this?
Yeah. From as early as the fur trade era, there was interchange between European newcomers and indigenous people, and some of that involved native people learning the fiddle, and so there has been a kind of a long-standing tradition of so-called Indian fiddling. And the recording you're going to hear I made at a wedding dance at the Menominee Reservation with Sarah Wapoos, whose husband and several of her children were fiddlers of Menominee and Potawatomi, jigs and reels and other kinds of tunes. And this figured in a larger film that can be seen online called Medicine Fiddle, that looks at fiddling and step dancing in among Native peoples in this Upper Midwest region.
Well, let's give a listen.
These old Indians used to say that the old-time music that you hear nowadays, it's nothing like what they used to play. They figured that they played the real music. And there was one old Indian now. He says, what you do? And this old Indian was blind. And he said, the papal tree has got music. He says, you go out in the woods. He said, I go out in the woods. And people used to see him out in the woods with his violin. And he said, there's music in the trees. And he told my husband, he said, you go stand out in the woods, he said, and listen. He said, just stand there and listen real good. He said, you'll hear that, it'll come to you. And he could play that old man. Where he learned, I don't know. My husband don't know either. He said he learned it from the trees. He said there's music in the trees.
And as Sarah is saying there, there's music in the trees. And Jim, you have been recording music, but it's not just the music. It's the stories behind it and the people behind it.
That's right. I think you can't really understand or appreciate the music fully unless you know a little bit about the community out of which it comes, and especially the amazing artists who've carried on this traditional music, and the quality of their voices, as you heard in that excerpt from Sarah, is something that you can't capture by any other means, and especially valuable as people, once people are gone.
And this is a story of change, too, it sounds like, Jim. We're not just capturing this historic relic, the authentic culture, but as you say, interplays between different cultures and how they evolve over time.
Yeah, the notion that any culture is pure and static is just ridiculous. Things are changing all the time, or else they cease to exist. And so that's true of any, whether it's food or music or dance or stories or whatever. There's always some kind of dynamic between the old and the new.
Is there a music that you're still hunting for? Maybe a holy grail that you've been hoping to hear somebody play that you've heard about but haven't gotten that performance you wanted?
Well, I've spent many, many years working with native people in this region, and a lot of the older, Germanic, Slavic, Nordic immigrant and ethnic groups. And I've also worked with Hmong and African American and Mexican American in this region. I would really love, to hear Somali musicians and singers in the region, and especially if some of their music is addressing, what's it like to be in Wisconsin and Minnesota and what they're encountering. That kind of stuff I'm intrigued by.
And what are you? You've received this Lifetime Achievement Award, but I imagine you, knowing you from talking to you so much, you're not done. What is next on your list, Jim?
Oh, well, I'm working on a couple of big projects. One is a reissue of rare Swiss yodeling recordings that were issued by a label in Monroe, Wisconsin in the early 1920s. And probably next year we'll have a 2-CD set, a little book out of that, the Helvetia label. And then you mentioned this NEH grant, Local Centers Global Sounds. We're working, the Mills Music Library and the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures, to put all kinds of field collections, as well as old 78 RPM recordings of regional and ethnic music, up online. And the first of those is up. If people want to search for Local Centers Global Sounds, they'll find this. And we're able to put up sound files, tape indexes, field notes, and lots of photographs as well. And I'm also working with some people on a 3-year project called Sustaining Scandinavian Folk Arts in the Upper Midwest that ties in a little bit with what Terry Van Orman was talking about earlier. Tomorrow night, a team of us are going to be in Argyle, Wisconsin, for a presentation on Ulebocking, this kind of disguised, masked house visiting that Norwegians have done. And this area around Argyle has been a kind of a hotbed of that, and we're asking people to share their memories and maybe bring some photographs.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison.
A stuffed animal has captured the attention of the internet, and not in a particularly good way.
All right, picture a giant teddy bear. It was advertised as 6 feet 5 inches tall. Looked pretty good on the distributor's website, but a lot of unhappy customers have been posting pictures and reviews that don't quite match the original.
So apparently customers have been receiving tall and pretty long teddy bears, but unlike normally proportioned bears in the ad, and it looks like a normal bear, these teddy bears are pretty much all legs.
Right. So it's a picture like a medium-sized teddy bear, but its legs extend out like three extra feet.
Extremely long legs. It's like seeing someone lounging around. Like, you'd think that a 6'5" teddy bear would be huge. It would take up a big proportion of the room.
It's weird. Look, it's a little disturbing as presented. I mean, think of it like it could be featured in the sequel to Donnie Darko, if you've seen that movie. And it has me wondering, like, if this is the real deal. Investigative reporters have better things to do with their time.
Sure.
I'm wondering if this is a hoax. I'm not sure.
I do think that maybe we will see something in a week. Maybe Vice will pick it up and they'll be investigating tall teddy bear. But regardless, it looks creepy.
All right. Well, look it up online. Maybe we'll tweet that out to you later at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I don't want to be your type.